Welcome to the Spring 2016 Conference of the South Carolina Jewish Historical Society. Courage, Conscience, and Conformity, South Carolina Jews and the Civil Rights Movement. I'm Ernie Marcus. I'm the incoming president of the Historical Society, and I welcome you all. I just wanted to tell you a couple of things first. After we had this wonderful meal, I want to thank Dee Dee Arthur and Fred and Mickey Rosenberg, who are out there cutting onions and cucumbers in the back. So, thank you very much. I also wanted to take the opportunity of making a pitch. And in the back of the newsletters, you'll see that you can, in fact, join the society. It's not closed. And we have a number of different levels of giving, from $36 to founding patron of $1,000. But I also wanted to emphasize our pillars, who contribute $5,000 over a three-year period. Over 5 years, I'm sorry. See, it's even a better deal. Wait another minute, it's an even better deal. And they are really, as the name implies, the foundation of the society. We wouldn't exist and wouldn't be able to put on programs like this without the pillars involved. I believe there are 38 today, and it's been growing because of Marty's involvement in particular over the last few years. So I want to encourage everybody to thank us on Facebook, and Ann Melman is, I just screwed up your name. Hellman. Right, added an M, has been very involved with the website. It's really beautiful now, and we're on Facebook. And so please take a look at it soon. I hope this conference will create a greater depth of understanding between the African-American community and the Jewish community here in South Carolina, because the communities have been linked in so many important ways for decades, and there's a lot more work to do. I also might mention there's a lot of food that to eat together, so feel free to get up and have some dessert in a little while. So I first wanted to go over how the day is going to go, and also tomorrow morning. And if you look at the schedule, first Dr. Bobby Donaldson from Carolina is going to be speaking today for about an hour. And then we'll give you about a five-minute break, and then we're going to start the first panel, which is being moderated by the Honorable Jean Toll, who's, the Supreme Court Justice for many years. And then we're going to have a 15-minute break after that. And that, by the way, that panel is going to be Rising to the Challenge, Jewish Politicians in an Age of Change. So around 3:30, we're going to start our second panel, which is Revisiting Rivers, Reflections on School Desegregation. The moderator for that would be John Hale, and you'll see the list of various speakers in your program. After that, at around 5 o'clock, actually 5:30, there's going to be a cocktail reception at Albert and Robin Mercer's residence on Ashley Avenue. The address is in the program. That's going to be great, out in the garden and in their home. It's going to be really terrific. Then tomorrow morning, we're starting with breakfast for anybody that wants to come to attend the board meeting. We're always scintillating topics at the board meeting. I'm sure everybody will be very excited. But then at 10 o'clock, we start our panel entitled Against the Tide, the Risks and Rewards of Rejecting the Status Quo. The moderator will be Cleveland Sellers, Jr., who's the president of Voorhees College. So that should be very interesting. And I hope everybody will come to both days, because it'll be worth it. So over the next couple of days, we'll be tackling the complex relationship between Jews and the civil rights movement. All of us here will view this time through different prisms, different race, different religion, different ages. Some of us were kids like me, some of us were adults, some weren't born yet. But it was, I can tell you, it was a very interesting period. Although you will hear about important exceptions, most South Carolina Jews went along with the views and actions of the dominant white Christian society. As Leonard Dinnerstein said in his writings, there was a deeply ambiguous response of Southern Jews to the desegregation crisis, and I would add for the whole period of the Civil Rights Movement. It's an interesting dynamic, I believe. Jews who have been persecuted for centuries observe the trials of their African-American neighbors. It was particularly striking in a place where I grew up in Utahville, South Carolina, which is 500 people. It's particularly striking where blacks and whites lived in close proximity in the rural areas. It was also, in my case as well, where there were Jewish merchants mostly selling, most of their trade was to African Americans, so there was exposure all the time during the midst of this tumult that was really happening during the 60s. And it's also important because many Jews were political leaders, as my father was the mayor of Utahville, and it was the case all over the state. At this conference, we'll explore this issue from all angles. We're very fortunate to have as our co-sponsor the African American Studies Program here at the College of Charleston. And we're going to have really some terrific speakers, and it's so great to see a big turnout here. Before I get started, I think we often don't talk about the magazine, but I hope everybody gets a chance to see it. There's an issue that looks like this, that's the actual newsletter, and then there's one that looks like this, that's just the program for today. But I think it's important for everybody to take a look at it. The first article in it was written by Millicent Brown, who's here somewhere. And we have a beautiful picture of her in the seventh grade or something like that. Yeah. And she writes about her experience during the desegregation of Rivers High School on the Charleston Peninsula, a school with a significant concentration of Jewish students. And Ms. Brown will be on the panel, I guess the first panel, the second panel. And we're very lucky to have her memories of that time. And you're going to see a number of familiar faces on that panel, like Robert Rosen. Next are three articles about the experience of leaving the public school system in the 60s as integration occurred. And that was written by me and also by Rachel Gordon Barnett. By the way, I started to wear the plaid pants. And I should have, because I'm standing behind the podium. You won't be able to see, but I didn't want to make anybody sick. But luckily, Rachel has brought her cheerleader's outfit. So, yeah. So she's going to be leading a pep rally between the first and the second panel. But the experience of going through integration and ending up at all-white private schools was especially poignant for Jewish kids, for all the reasons that you can imagine. The next article was written by Judy Kurtz Goldman, who writes beautifully about her personal experiences of growing up in the segregated Rock Hill, South Carolina, and also about the Friendship Nine, which were nine African Americans who were arrested for integrating the McCrory's lunch counter. Turning to politics, the last three articles are about Hyman Rubin Sr., Isidore Lurie, and the Keiserling family. Judge Toll will introduce these authors later in the program. This one ends with a big thanks to Dale Rosengarten, as well as an assist from Ted and Alyssa Neely, as well as the working committee that included Marty, Enid, Rachel, Lily, and I was involved. And I think we all felt very strongly in this topic and really put a lot of love and effort into putting this together. So our first speaker is Dr. Donaldson. He's an associate professor of history at Carolina and the faculty principal of Reston Residential College there. He received a BA at Wesleyan and a PhD at Emory, and he held fellowships at Dartmouth and the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard. Dr. Donaldson is a scholar of Southern history and African-American life and culture in the 19th and 20th century. He served as a consultant to museum exhibitions, documentary films, and historic preservation projects. He's currently directing the Columbia, South Carolina 63 Our Story Matters, a documentary film initiative that chronicles the struggle for civil rights and social justice in South Carolina in 1963 and beyond. That's That's Dr. Donaldson.
It came apart.
You're supposed to take this with you when you walk away.
Well, thank you very much. I want to begin by, first of all, I was meant to be here earlier, but I got stuck in downtown Charleston traffic, unanticipated. I want to thank Dale Rosengarten for her persistence in inviting me to be here today. Now, I have several stacks of paper, because I think I over-prepared for the occasion. But the first stack, first sheet, is my email to Dale saying, what a great program. Here are the people you should include. Here's some thought you should address. But I am not prepared to be a keynote speaker. And I thought I was pretty emphatic in that point. And here I am. So, ladies and gentlemen, I've never felt more ill-prepared in an address as I am today, probably because this is not my primary area of focus, but I've learned a great deal since Dale gave me the homework assignment. I'm also a little uneased because in the back is my dissertation advisor, who's here, Dan Carter. So he'll correct any of the errors I make along the way, along with Millicent and my colleague, Pat Sullivan. I stand here today really following a course outlined by two individuals that I'd like to credit for my initial journey into this topic. The first person is a young man named Ronan Rappaport. Ronan was a resident in Preston College, where I'm the faculty principal. And one year, I taught a documentary history course on the civil rights movement built around the Columbia SC63 project that I'm leading. Ronan took that class, and I asked each of the students, based on the readings we had up to that date, to come up with their own research topic. Now, that is a Herculean task for most students. Come up with your own research topic. So Ronan sent me a page list of things he was interested in, and one of them was the role of Jewish merchants in the civil rights movement. So I wrote him back. I said, Ronan, your initial research underscores the important work that needs to be done to add more detail to the accounts of Jewish contributions to the modern civil rights movement. It strikes me that you have surprised yourself by the amount of material that is slowly emerging on the topic, and I think further reading in both the secondary and primary sources will further clarify some of the issues. I especially encourage you to examine the families, the David Baker family in Columbia, Isidore Lurie, Hyman Rubin, the papers of Mayor Lester Bates, and also the photography of David Wallace. And Ronan took that assignment and came back with an extraordinary research paper that helps to frame what I want to say today. One of the persons that I also encouraged him to speak with was a gentleman named Max Gergel, a businessman who lives in Columbia. Max was, and he asked me to call him Max, though I reference him frequently as Mr. Gergel, lived in the area near the South Carolina Governor's Mansion, area called Arsenal Hill. And on one occasion like this, I was in a room, I was at Max's table, and he told me about living in Arsenal Hill. He told me about his memories of his African-American neighbors. And when the Historic Columbia Foundation was engaged in a documentary history project of communities around Columbia, I asked that Mr. Gergel be included in the oral interviews that we conducted. So one afternoon, about 6 years ago, Max Gergel and his partner met me on the corner of Hampton and Park Street in downtown Columbia. Most people know it as the Big Apple. And when Mr. Gergel, who at that time in his late 80s, slowly came up the stairs, tears were flowing down his eyes. He greeted me graciously, and he said, "You have no idea what this means to me. To come back into a place, my synagogue. We know it is the Big Apple, but I knew it as a place of worship 70 years ago. Here is where I learned my history. Here is where I had my first education." And during the course of that three-hour interview, Mr. Gergel kept referring to the work of his mother, Jenny Seidemann, and the role she played in civil rights in Columbia and throughout South Carolina in the 1940s and 1950s. And he particularly referenced her relationship with Modjeska Monteith Simpkins, the woman on the left, and John Henry McCrae, who was the leader of the South Carolina Progressive Democratic Party. And Mr. Gergel's mother and his stepfather were strong financial backers of the Progressive Democratic Party and of the NAACP. They were members of this organization. And Max began to talk about these detailed relationships between his parents and these pioneering civil rights figures. And when we concluded the discussion, he told me that he was writing a memoir and that he wanted my assistance, and would I promise that I would help him complete the task before he was no longer able to do so. And I promised that I would do so. But as circumstances would have it, things got in the way. Max and I have not had much contact in those years. He's now 95, 96, not able to finish that task. So perhaps this new assignment, Dale, might be a way to return to the task that Max Gergel asked me to take on some years ago. As I was thinking about what it was that I wanted to discuss today, much of what I will discuss are simply sort of flashpoints in the broad topic to set the stage for what I know to be a very engaging conversation among all of our panelists. Now, Dan Carter, who was a student at Carolina, this is the 1946 Southern Negro Youth Congress. Max Gergel's parents were financial supporters of this. This is the famed civil rights figure Paul Robeson shaking hands with a man named Willis Johnson. One of the current projects I'm working on now with the Columbia 63, a new U.S. History Civil Rights Center, and the History Center at USC, led by my colleague Pat Sullivan, is looking at the 70th anniversary of the Southern Negro Youth Congress. And an important component of that observation will be the role of Jewish activists who were very much a part of organizing, shaping that movement in the 1940s. And I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Dan Carter, who is my graduate advisor, is also a graduate of Carolina. And one time in our graduate course on the New South, he talked about a need to know more about an early USC president, whose name was Mitchell Childs, who was a race person who helped to frame dialogues about interracial work and interracial conversations in the early 20th century. And one of Professor Mitchell's friends was a man named Josiah Morris, born in Richmond, Virginia in 1879 as Joseph Moses, who later became a professor at USC, but who was someone who was unabashedly supportive of improved race relations and did so openly. In 1912, Professor Morris went on a lecture circuit where he underscored the following: the need for courses in the study of the race problem, that these courses should be introduced in every Southern college and university. This is in 1912. In 1916, this very distinguished Jewish professor at Carolina begins to write articles and essays railing against lynching and racial violence, insisting, quote, the college man belongs in the front rank of those fighting for moral and social progress. In 1919, he holds court with President Woodrow Wilson, underscoring the same point. As Professor Morris is engaged in this work on race relations and civil rights activities, he's fully aware of the immediate dangers that would attend such work as a white professor and certainly as a Jewish professor. Around the same time, his friend, August Kahn, who had served for 24 years on the Board of Trustees at the University of South Carolina, was targeted by the KKK and dismissed from his role on the Board of Trustees at USC. Despite the obvious hurdles that Professor Morris encountered and would likely encounter, he remained dedicated to the cause of racial justice. Two of his students, who were inspired by him in the classroom and also by his civic work, later went on to distinguish themselves as pioneers in race relations improvement and civil rights. Marion Wright, who began associated with the South Carolina Conference on Human Relations, credited Professor Morris with opening his eyes to a world that he only narrowly saw. He said, he taught us not merely to question, but Professor Morris taught us to repudiate the pleasant assumption of my own superiority as a white person over any Negro, however able. This was a revolutionary doctrine at the time, but I embraced it without hesitation, and it has become a permanent part of my personal creed. Another person who was equally influenced by Professor Morris was Hyman Rubin, who you'll hear about later from my colleague, Reverend Marvin Lair. But when thinking about the influence of Professor Morris on his career, Hyman Rubin said, by precept and example, he taught tolerance, understanding, and brotherhood. Even the most hard shell, when exposed to him, acquired respect for other people's rights, privileges, and beliefs. And in one important episode that I just came across, there's a great master's thesis done in the last couple of years at Carolina about Professor Morris. And based on oral interviews with his family, one of his closest intellectual associates in the early part of the 20th century was the great civil rights historian and champion W.E.B. Du Bois. When Du Bois comes to Columbia to engage in research on his book, Black Reconstruction, the family notes that Du Bois lived in the home of Josiah Morris. He extended an invitation to Du Bois to visit the house, but said expressly, you must enter the front door. Another unusual personality that I learned about with this assignment was one shared with me by Dale of Joseph Fromberg, who joined the South Carolina Bar in 1911 and was ousted from his post as city recorder here in Charleston in 1946. In 1948, Fromberg, who is on the far left, sends two powerful missives, one to Wendell Rivers and one to William Bryant Dorn. And if you've not seen these letters, Dale, are they on your website, that letter?
Not yet.
Yeah, but it will be. Read them. What was he so upset about? On the date in August 1948, when this group here assembles to vote in a downtown Columbia voting district, on the very same day these individuals gather to vote as African Americans, able to do so by a great civil rights case ruling, Elmore v. Rice, rendered by Judge J. Wadis Waring here in Charleston, Frumberg receives a message asking lawyers to repudiate Waring. But instead of falling in line with many other lawyers at the time, Frumberg writes the following. He said, "Judge Waring is a highly capable, honest, and fearless member of the bench. He lambasted Dorn and Rivers and demanded they cease from their, quote, foolish, puerile, and useless course. He also published similar sentiments in the New York Herald and in the Charleston News and Courier. He said, I fear you are too deeply linked with men of the ilk of the Jew-hating bigot Rankin," meaning John Elliott Rankin of Mississippi, who Time magazine labeled during that same time period as the number one Jew hater in the House of Representatives. Now, ironically, the person for whom the Elmore case is named was George Elmore, who was a downtown merchant in Columbia, in the African American community, who many argued or rumored had a Jewish father in Holly Hill. And if you ever see a picture of Elmore, you will know he could pass. And many people I've interviewed said that his father was a strong champion. But who that father is remains a real mystery. By the way, I'll just point out, the first person in this line had great memories of George Elmore and this period of African-American mobilization in the 1940s. She was among those who voted in August of 1948. Today, she is 106 years old and has vivid memories of that occasion and all who were with her. She is now legally blind and deaf, but this memory is chiseled in her mind, and she can describe it as though she were looking at it. Her name is Donella Brown Wilson. Now, one of the individuals that I think will come up, I suppose, at various points through the course of our weekend is perhaps the most powerful and influential Jewish leader in South Carolina history. While a student at Carolina, Saul Blatt was the Speaker of the House from 1937 to 1973. Let me repeat that. Saul Blatt was Speaker of the House. He was your Speaker, right, Judge Toll? He was Speaker of the House from 1937 to 1973. Saul Blatt, I don't think there is much room to contest, was not a champion of civil rights. Indeed, from the very beginning of his career, he made that point absolutely clear. A year after his selection as Speaker of the House, a young man named Charles Bruce Bailey, who was a graduate of Morehouse College, African American, applied to attend the law school at the University of South Carolina. Now, what was ironic about Charles Bruce Bailey's application to Carolina is that he was a legacy. His great-grandfather, Paris Simpkins, received a law degree from the University of South Carolina in the 1870s, when USC was a predominantly African-American institution. But despite the legacy, Bailey's application was quickly dismissed by Representative Blatt. In August of 1938, he said the following, which can be found in the records of the Board of Trustees of USC. "The white people of South Carolina need not have any fear as to what will become of this application. The Board of Trustees will do everything in their power to maintain the University of South Carolina for white students only. And in doing so, will protect other institutions as well. Now, Black's response, being a member of the Board of Trustees and also being a member of the House of Representatives, his absolute refusal to even give an audience to Bailey or members of the NAACP who were advocating for his admission, that position did not go uncontested. A young aspiring professor at Benedict College named Gurney Nelson responded to Black's statements in an open published letter in the state newspaper and in other African American publications. Now, I want to read a part of it without offering much explanation to see if you recognize really how creative and powerful this young professor's rebuttal is to a powerful political figure. He says, during the past few months, this is 1938, during the past few months, the sensibility of the civilized world has been shocked as a result of the inhumane treatment of Jews by German people. Those of us who've lived side by side Jews, who have had social dealings with them, who have noted their thrift, who've envied their record as a race, wonder why they are made to suffer brutality, suppression, and even death at the hands of European despotism. Professor Nelson reminded Saul Blatt, who is an attorney, of a recent ruling at the University of Missouri, a ruling called Gaines v. Canada, that made possible an African American to enroll in the law school at Missouri. He says the following: this was a significant ruling of its time. From every platform and pulpit, we've heard the watchword social justice. This is 1938. Nelson drew the attention to the hypocrisy of condemning atrocities inflicted upon Jews while supporting the subordination of Black people. He says, Mr. Blatt, here is your opportunity to show your real self. Here is your opportunity personally to follow in the footsteps of that noble spirit, Julius Rosenwald, who had financed many African American schools around the Deep South. Mr. Rosenwald, who has made possible a fuller, happier life for a suppressed minority because he realized the necessity of doing so. Now, I'm not sure if Blatt responded directly to Professor Nelson's commentary or not, but we do know that within several weeks, he put forward a bill to finance a separate law school in Orangeburg for African American students. He says the following: Negroes pay their taxes too. But this is what I found quite intriguing. He says, he's speaking to his fellow members of the House of Representatives, I want to tell you they have someone at the head of the NAACP that is really smart. And he's referencing Thurgood Marshall. Now, although he conceded slightly to develop a separate school in Orangeburg, that was not to be for several more years when the Senate refused to support the bill passed in the House in 1938. But again, Blatt remained quite consistent in his sentiments about the need to maintain segregation at whatever cost. There are many details we could fill in along the way, but I think an important moment to reference is this moment. This is the Columbia Township Auditorium. The date is January 26, 56. On the very same day, Max Gergel's mother's friend, Majeska Simpkins, is driving down through Sumter to get to Clarendon County to deliver financial support to African-American families who had faced an economic squeeze in the aftermath of supporting the case that ultimately becomes Briggs v. Elliott that rose up into the Brown v. Education. So in 1954, Supreme Court ruling happens. This is 2 years later, January of 1956. Now, as part of the Columbia 63 project, we started uncovering or searching for many photographs about civil rights in Columbia and around South Carolina. And I was working with my colleague Robin Waits from Historic Columbia, who's here, and we started looking at a series of national publications. And there's a great photograph, and I wish I'd emailed Robin last night. There's another photograph of the stage on this same day. So while Majeska Simpkins and other NAACP figures are driving to Somerton in Clarendon County, she recounts a story of seeing headlights upon headlights of cars on their way to Columbia. It was an important gathering. It was a meeting of the statewide White Citizens Council. The keynote speaker for the day was Senator James O. Eastland. Beneath the stars and bars, if you look further on the right, you will see the Confederate flag welcoming an audience. Standing on the stage with Eastland is the who's who of politics in South Carolina: Strom Thurmond, Jimmy Burns, Olin D. Johnston, and the Speaker of the House, Saul Block. During one particular moment, while Strom Thurmond is speaking, that apparently is when the Confederate flag is unfurled from one of the balcony areas. During the very same time that this is happening, we have the Montgomery bus boycott under full effect in Alabama. There's a similar bus movement occurring also in Columbia as well. During this very same week when this gathering happens, the General Assembly passes a bill, a joint resolution, condemning and protesting the usurpation and encroachment, these are their legal terms, of the reserved powers of states by the Supreme Court of the United States. Also at that gathering was the Reverend L.B. McCord, who was superintendent of schools in Clarendon County, who said the following from the platform: "We believe in our hearts that we should remain white as God created us. We believe in our hearts that we should remain as God created us," acknowledging the need not to move toward integration. Also present at that event was Mendel Rivers, who was a horrid car segregationist, if there ever was one. He received raucous applause when he calls the NAACP the National Association for the Advancement of a Communistic Propaganda. Someone who could have been there, but who was not, I'm told that somewhere in this group there were reserved seats for Negroes, but none were taken that evening. And one can imagine why that would have been the case. In 1957 to 58, there are a series of Jewish professors at Carolina and Allen University that I think merit further attention, as Saul Blatt is in full sway of power. One professor is named Joseph Margolis, who is still living, still teaching at Temple University. In 1957 and 58, he was a young, untenured assistant professor at the University of South Carolina. He was well known in the community would often give speeches and addresses to civic organizations as well. But in 1958, Joseph Margolis publishes an essay called The Role of the Segregationist. So without calling names, it's obvious to whom he's referring. He said, quote, "The Southern segregationists can find answers for the inexplicable plight of the Negro only in unreasonable mouthings about racial inferiority and contradictory testimony of the ingratitude, disease, stupidity, arrogance of the Negro." When in fact, he argued, Margolis, that white people had an inferiority complex of their own. The president of the time receives a short message from Saul Blatt in responding to Margolis's public rants against segregation. He says, quote, "Positive action should be taken by the university to get him to resign or fire him." And that happens thereafter. Margolis later writes about what occurred and the career he had thereafter. In 1959, Saul Blatt is invited. I can't see the date over there. Sure. What's the date?
April 6th, 1959.
All right. April 6th, 1959. Has anyone read this address before? It's eye-opening. So he's brought forward to commit to celebrate, to mark the 175th anniversary of the Hebrew Benevolent Society, and he is here in Charleston, April 1959. This is what he says. He first ridicules any Jewish champions of civil rights or improved race relations. And then he offers an astounding revisionist account of history. These are his words in April of 1959. "We know that in South Carolina, we already have excellent relationships between the races. And what we find on television is a misrepresentation. The Negro race, no, my friends, the Negro race, nor any other race, is oppressed in South Carolina. I am a living example of the tolerance of the people of this great state. People of all races in South Carolina can look forward with confidence to the future, knowing full well that if they have character, talents, and abilities, if they exert themselves, they will be recognized and appreciated." Now, I'm not sure what world this powerful, well-informed, influential politician is living. But I think this weekend's programs and conversation allow us to take on Saul Blatt in terms of understanding what really was happening in South Carolina during this pivotal moment of the 20th century. In talking about the improved race relations, Saul Blatt fails to reference at all the Reverend James Hinton, the longstanding president of the South Carolina Conference of the NAACP, who in 1948, months before African Americans are voting for the first time as Democrats, is invited to the Tree of Life in Columbia. He was one of the very first African Americans to be given an audience with that congregation. And look at his title, the very bottom lines: "Separate but equal or complete integration." And this was the point of real discussion among NAACP lawyers and leaders during the late 1940s and early 1950s. And it is at the Tree of Life in Columbia where Dr. Hinton engages in this discussion. So in the same sort of time frame where all is well in the life of Saul Blatt, we are aware of strong contention among African Americans that life must be better. He fails to forget, he fails to reference with the burning of the home of J. Delane in Clarendon County during the very same window of time that is discussing improved race relations in South Carolina. Here an African Methodist Episcopal minister leads a protest movement in Clarendon County calling for the end of segregation in public schools and faces a series of violent assaults and reprisals. This is the Delane family in Somerton, I think in 1956, standing outside of their burned home. Now, I wish I had a better photo of this. This is, again, just to remind you of the world in which Saul Blatt lives. There is John F. Kennedy. This is October of 1960. The governor, Ernest Hollings, Olin D. Johnston. And there's another frame. Again, I should email Robin. We have this great photo of John Kennedy in the middle, and Blatt stays on the side, flanked by Hollings and Johnston. And Hollings is giving a gift to the Democratic candidate for president. You might imagine what the gift is? It's a brilliant picture. It's a Confederate flag. And it's almost as though Kennedy steps back, trying to figure out what the appropriate response is to this generous gift. This is Reverend Ida Quincy Newman, who I think we'll hear about later today, again, doing this sort of moment of amnesia. In the Hebrew society, Blatt seems to forget the active work of the NAACP, of Ida Quincy Newman, Ms. Brown's father, J. Arthur Brown, right here in Charleston while he's speaking. And we'll hear more about a lot of that today as well. This is 1964. I'm going to let you take a moment to read it. I'm trying to find my letter I have from Ida Quincy Newman. Well, instead of trying to waste time finding it, let me sort of offer a short sort of explanation of this. There are two letters that are in the Ida Quincy Newman papers. One of them is a letter from the Speaker of the House saying, surely this is a mistake. Surely this is a real joke. And Newman responds back by saying, surely it's a joke. You're clearly not worthy of being a member of the NAACP. And at some point, Newman reminds the Speaker of the House that this is 1964, that the world you fought fiercely to protect is poised for change. This is only weeks before the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And Newman is alerting the Speaker that he should prepare himself to be uncomfortable but what's on the horizon. Another unusual figure, and I'm mindful of time, but so I will sort of just do a brief overview of some additional points. As the powerful, influential Speaker of the House, hold force for over 50 years, there are other voices that clearly demonstrate different angles and perceptions of understanding what needs to be done to improve race relations. In 1960, Harry Golden, who was the publisher of the Carolina Israelite, published in Charlotte, is on the lecture circuit. And the Kiwanis Club in Greenville has invited him. Now, they are fully aware of who he is and his advocacy for civil rights. But several days before Golden is to appear in Greenville, his speech is canceled. And the Kiwanis Club leader explains why, that increasingly people are nervous about what you're saying, but also about your influence and what is happening. Again, this is the spring of 1960. And I'll explain why Harry Golden, Jewish supporter of civil rights, is becoming increasingly an annoyance to the defenders of the status quo. Now, one of Harry Golden's closest champions lived not too far from here. And until Dell gave me the assignment, I never connected the dots of the association between this Jewish activist, Harry Golden, and the Charleston activist, Septima Poinsett Clark. And all you have to do, Donaldson, is read the books on your shelf.
Right.
Look at the bottom. So I should talk to you, Millicent. And in the book, they explain their relationship and the need for increased collaboration between progressive forces among African Americans and Jewish residents. Dale, how do you pronounce Rabbi's
Walpig?
For those who have not spent hours reading the transcriptions of oral histories that are available here on the campus, please do so. It is eye-opening in terms of the discussions we're having today, and also about individuals who were willing to move forward moderately toward improved race relations, and a phenomenal price many paid. There are several rabbis who offer commentary about the tensions they faced not only within Charleston and other parts of the state, but within their own congregations, and the constant battles of whether or not ministers should be these public figures championing civil rights. And he offers, this Rabbi Wolpe talks about standing on a powder keg, knowing that whatever you say from the pulpit may well be a trigger, literally. And here he is serving here in Charleston while other synagogues are being bombed all across the Deep South between 1957 and 1960. While Saul Blatt is providing this narrow understanding about race relations in South Carolina, he seems to forget or intentionally overlooks an important milestone that is happening as the White Citizens Council is meeting. The date is June 22nd, 1954. Several weeks after the Brown v. Board decision. In the mind of this 19-year-old woman, it was an ordinary day. Her name was Sarah Mae Fleming. She was a 19-year-old domestic for a USC family who lived near Five Points in Columbia. On that day, Sarah Mae Fleming boards a downtown bus. She transfers on the corner of Main and Taylor Streets. She sits at what was called the Mason-Dixon line of the bus that would change as more white people got on. But for whatever reason, within two blocks, Fleming sits down, more white people get on the bus, and she refuses to move. When she is ordered, forcefully demanded to leave the bus on June 22nd, 54. She does so, but she tries to go out of the front door. The driver elbows her in the midsection, she's knocked over, and she's compelled to sort of force her way through the crowd to the back door. June 22nd, 54. One of the first calls that she and her friend make, who's on the bus with her, is to Majeska Simpkins. Simpkins then calls a Columbia Jewish lawyer and entrepreneur named David Baker, who then calls this young lawyer named Philip Wittenberg to see if he would be willing to take on the case of Sarah Mae Fleming as she files suit against the Electric and Gas Company of South Carolina. June 22nd, 1954, 17 months before Rosa Parks in Montgomery, Alabama. Wittenberg confronts the establishment as he takes on her case. He confronts Judge George Bell Timmerman and Governor George Bell Timmerman Jr., who are absolutely supporting the continuation of segregation. He confronts crosses being burned in his home. And a headline story in the state newspaper discussed that he was being targeted by phone and also by visits to his home. As Sarah Mae Fleming's case called Fleming v. South Carolina moves forward, Wittenberg concedes that he is no longer able to handle the case given the reprisals he faces. So he hands over the case to the young attorney, Matthew J. Perry, and the other young attorney, Lincoln C. Jenkins, who both take the case of Sarah Mae Fleming. Ultimately, Ms. Fleming's case stalls, but it is used in the final case of Browder v. Gale, which was a ruling that brought down the end of segregation in Montgomery, Alabama. But the footnote is, before there was an end of segregation in the buses of Montgomery, there was already an end of segregation legally to the buses in Columbia, brought forward by this unsung hero, Sarah Mae Fleming, and her Jewish attorney, Philip Wittenberg. This is Sarah Mae Fleming in 1957 or 58 on the steps of the federal courthouse in Columbia. She's flanked by Lincoln Jenkins, her best friend Julia King, who was a witness, and the transcript of that exchange between the prosecution and this Mrs. King is phenomenal. Two women who were going to say exactly what they thought about the situation, and Judge Matthew Perry as well. To try to bring this to a close and our time for questions, this is Allen University in 1960. March 3rd, 1960. Until the Columbia 63 Project evolved, we knew of occasions of civil rights demonstrations in Columbia. We knew of certain accounts in the local newspapers. My graduate school mentor, Dan Carter, was a student here at the time and told me of accounts as well. But we knew very few people personally or directly. And then in 2013, as we were launching this project, I received a phone call from a young woman who told me that she was cleaning out the home of her father in Forest Acres on the outskirts of Columbia. And when I went to the home with one of my graduate students, we found boxes of negatives of newspaper, of photographs. We also found prints of photographs of protest, of demonstrations. There were extraordinary images. And the home was once occupied by a real estate developer named David Wallace, who lived in Columbia. I knew of Mr. Wallace as one of the founders of the Columbia Urban League in the late 1960s. So I knew of his advocacy for improved race relations and civil rights. But very few people knew of Dave Wallace as a photographer who was on a retainer by the NAACP, who would frequently go out seemingly as an amateur photographer and take powerful images of the civil rights movement in Colombia. And that was one of them. Another individual that I won't discuss today, but Ira Kay, who lived in Sumter. And I think, Dale, as an oral history that you've done with him as well. Ira Kay was a dues-paying member of the NAACP in Sumter when it was illegal to be a member of the NAACP. He was also one of the founding members of the Sacramento Council on Human Relations and also a member of the United States Civil Rights Commission. And there's a great collection of papers at the university that chronicle Ira Kay's advocacy for improved conditions in rural South Carolina and also the reprisals he faces doing such advocacy. One of Ira Kay's biggest champions was this Rabbi David Gruber from Columbia, who was also a dues-paying member of the NAACP. And some have asked me, well, how do you know that? I said, I found his membership card in the papers of Majeska Simpkins. She kept those cards with his wife. When Ira Kay was seeking membership for people to join the South Carolina Council on Human Relations, one gentleman wrote back who was a businessman in Columbia who said, we wish no association or contact with this unconstitutional socialistic scheme to hogtie American freedom. And then he put the Goldwater sticker in the envelope, 1964. To demonstrate exactly where he felt politically as there was this advocacy for improved race relations. Hyman Rubin, my friend Marvin Lair, will discuss. Rubin also was a quiet, dues-paying member of the NAACP who provided great financial resources in many of the rural areas that were faced by the economic reprisals in the mid-1950s. Although his name is not here, this campaign to bring supplies and support to Orangeburg in 1955 and 56 was enabled by the financial support of Hyman Rubin during that time period. And I think Marvin has an interview with one of my mentors, Albert Redd, who speaks about the influence of Mr. Rubin. This is the last thing I want to discuss. This is March 2nd, 1961. Some of these photographs are taken by David Wallace. Some of them were taken by the state newspaper where we found caches of unprocessed photographs that were never publicized about civil rights in Colombia. But this day was particularly pivotal in the civil rights struggle. This is March 2nd, 61. There had already been sit-ins and demonstrations here in Charleston, in Rock Hill, in Greenville, in every city around the state, in every big city around the state. And many of those student leaders from the NAACP Youth and College Divisions gathered in Columbia for a protest at the State House. At the State House, where Saul Blatt is the Speaker of the House. 300 of them march from Zion Baptist Church to downtown Columbia. Among that group includes Ida Quincy Newman, the Reverend B.J. Glover, who at the time served as pastor of Mother Emanuel ME Church here. It included a young James Clyburn. It also included on the sidelines a young high school student named Jean Hafer-Toll, who witnessed this event happen. And as I was telling this account, and this is again only something I discovered recently, someone asked me, were there any Jewish participants in the protest? And I said, well, I'm not aware of any, until Dale gave me the assignment. On the far right is a gentleman named Charles McDue. Now, besides Pat Sullivan and Millicent, anyone else heard of him? Charles McDue was one of the founders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. in 1960. But he emerges as a student activist in the late 50s, early 60s in Orangeburg. And this is a photo, this is a still shot of moving image footage of McDew in downtown Orangeburg in March of 1960. In March of 1961, McDew comes to Columbia for the State House March. He comes with these men and women here. But when he comes, Charles McDew is Jewish. In his account, he says that in 1959, he's a student in Orangeburg at South Carolina State College. And there is an annual event called Religious Emphasis Week. And McDew says, as he comes into college, he's not a terribly religious person, but he's clearly committed to the cause of civil rights. In fact, if I can find his line, he says, "I'm black by birth, a Jew by choice, and a revolutionary by necessity." When this article is published in 1962, it is a three-page article about how a black activist embraces Judaism as a faith. And what he says is that during that Religious Emphasis Week, there was a Catholic priest, a white Catholic priest, there was a white Protestant, and there was a rabbi who offered remarks. And I wish we could figure out, I've not found who that is. Is it Gruber, who comes from Columbia periodically to Orangeburg, or is it Aaron Levy from Sumter who comes? And we do have record that Levy comes to Orangeburg on a regular basis. But after the men were speaking, McDew asked, "That was powerful information you all conveyed. May I come to your worship service?" The priest says no. The Protestant minister says no. But the Jewish rabbi invites McDew in. Later, when explaining why he makes this shift from Methodism to Judaism, he says Judaism represents justice, brotherhood, social consciousness. Now, I mentioned this is a particular brand of Judaism in his mind. Judaism represents justice, brotherhood, active concern for your fellow man, and oneness of mankind. As he says that, these are some of the very same sentiments being argued by activists in the movement. This is a photograph of 1960 by, again, David Wallace. And I want to underscore why what is happening this weekend is so important. That as not only as we recount history, but we revise history as well. This is a photograph Wallace took at the bus station in Columbia on the corner of Blanding and Sumter Street. Again, these are hundreds of photographs we have as negatives. We started blowing some of them up. We put this photograph on display at a local recreation center during one of our public events. And part of the goal is trying to add names and details to these phenomenal photographs. These four women were Benedict College students, sophomores, in 1960. They are photographs being taken by Wallace. And what I've always been struck by is they almost seem posed to some degree. Or they seem comfortable with a photographer whose lens is focused on them. And later I learned, in talking to some of the student participants, was that Wallace would attend quietly some of the planning meetings. Some of this was quite well orchestrated. That's David Wallace in his later years. And this is one of several documents his daughter had which she could make sense of. This is a handwritten note that David Wallace provides a recount of what happened to him in Orangeburg when he goes to take photographs of students in the spring of 1960. And he says he wanted to write it down, put it in an envelope, mail it to his home in case something happened to him. And again, he's fully aware of what those in cases are. This is a picture he takes of Millis Brown's father in the middle with Ida Quincy Newman and Levi Byrd, a great NAACP champion, and Dewey Duckett as well. Matthew Perry and Ida Quincy Newman with women who are raising money. These are the young men and women that I neglected to say who were arrested at the State House, tried, and convicted. And in 1963, the United States Supreme Court overturns that conviction in a famous case called Edwards v. South Carolina. And you can now say a Jewish student was in that march, defended by a Jewish attorney. Here are the local attorneys, Matthew Perry and Lincoln Jenkins. As the case goes forward toward the appellate, a brilliant lawyer named Greenberg takes on the case. And a few years ago, we interviewed Greenberg. And he said to us, we said, so what did you have to do to make this case so successful? He said, not much at all. He said it was one of the word he used was pure. It was argued so well by the local attorneys and the students themselves in their own orchestration of the march that it was not a terribly difficult case to argue at all. So he turned the credit back over to these young men and women. This photograph is David Wallace's picture of civil rights figures at Benedict College and Allen University. This is a young man named David Carter, who Dan Carter knew quite well, with two other gentlemen. And the man in the middle is named Moses Javis. And he's still living in Jacksonville, Florida. And he has great accounts of David Wallace. He said Wallace came to his home, he came to church service with him, was a strong presence. But the point is, no one knew that. His daughter had no idea about his role, had no idea of his contributions to the movement. While this was all happening, he was a member of the Josiah Morris Lodge in Columbia, and also a member of the B'nai B'rith as well. When Dale asked me to talk today, and when I said, you should find someone else, she said, well, I need a title. I said, okay. So I said, let me find a song that can just fit, and I'll make it work somehow. The song was called Let Us Break Bread Together. Now, I knew by the time I got here in Charleston, I would find some way that song was used in the movement in South Carolina. Millicent is now nodding it was. I should talk to her. So here is a clear song that offers a reflection on the past. Let us break bread together on our knees. Let us break bread together on our knees. When I fall on my knees with my face to the rising sun, O Lord, have mercy on me. Now again, I was hoping that this would connect somehow. But then as I was driving here today, thinking about all of these individuals, all of these stories, and thinking about the first time I met Max Gergel, and we sat down, and on a series of occasions for lunch, talking about the past, talking about history. And he told me it was so important that these stories be captured, recorded, and preserved while many of those individuals are still with us. So although the title was perhaps appropriate as we reflected back, it seems to me that it's quite appropriate for where we are today. As we seek to gather, to engage in conversations, to tell untold stories about the movement, its challenges, its struggles, to complete a more deeper and fuller history of the struggle for social justice in South Carolina. So rather than offering a keynote address today, I hope I've offered a framework for the series of panels that will come thereafter. Thank you very much. I neglected to say that this is a photograph in front of Mother Emanuel in the summer of 1963 when they're protesting merchants down on Meeting Street here in Columbia, in Charleston. King Street. Right.